The following program is presented by the North Carolina Reading Service, and it's intended for our audience of blind and print-impaired listeners. And I'm John Feddersen, and hope you'll join me for the next hour, and we'll listen to a current issue of Indie Week. This issue is dated March the 23rd of 2022. And there's a good bit of material here, including some little bits that I think we'll find interesting, a cultural calendar. I hope we have time to get to them, and we will if I stop doing the introduction. So stay tuned. And since I've opened the paper version of Indie Week first, I'll start with a couple of articles from news from the paper edition. There are also several articles in the online indieweek.org. But first, Tomasi McDonald's called Minds Not Meeting. Durham Black Liberation Minister Paul Scott has often been the city's Socratic gadfly that calls attention to grassroots issues with biting commentary that pierces the skin of an elephantine local government. Last month, the slim, respectable minister posted a YouTube video accusing Elaine O'Neill, the city's first black woman to serve as mayor, of secretly meeting with gang members amid her ongoing effort to curb the city's gun violence epidemic. The YouTube video begins with Scott standing behind a podium draped in a flag featuring the Pan-Africanist red, black, and green colors alongside shelves stocked with books. He announces he wants to discuss an issue, quote, that people in Durham are talking about. And he goes on, they are talking about the secret meetings that our mayor, Elaine O'Neill, is involved in and members of the city council are involved in to stop violence in Durham, to stop the shootings in Durham. That's the purpose. But some of us have a problem with that strategy because it's secret meetings that's got the black community in the condition that it's in right now. Should the mayor of a city be involved in secret meetings and not talking to the press and not keeping the community informed? No. Scott says during the little over 20-minute video. He adds that the murders of black leaders like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King Jr. were the result of secret meetings. Scott later says O'Neill was asked why she's not talking publicly about the gun violence and that the mayor said she's, quote, having meetings with gangs, with the streets, and that the gang members don't trust the government. The accusation incensed O'Neill. She told the Indy, there have been no secret meetings. More than 100 people have attended a retreat that we held with gang members at City Council member Mark Anthony Middleton's church. Middleton, an ordained pastor, says the retreat took place at his church shortly after O'Neill became mayor-elect. It was done before she was sworn in, says Middleton, adding, the purpose of the retreat was to hear from officials with Haiti Reborn, an initiative that envisions a vibrant residential, educational, and economic district across the historically black Fayetteville Street corridor. Middleton says about 100 people, including media, were at the retreat. There were some folk there who I definitely recognized as gang members. He says, was the mayor-elect interacting with them? Absolutely. Because of her rapport, the mayor has an ability to navigate in spaces the rest of us don't have. You can be aghast, but you can't be surprised. Durham County Sheriff Clarence Burkhead this week told Indy, it's not unusual for him to meet with residents one-on-one, two-on-two, with the understanding we can accomplish a lot together. He added that sometimes the work to stop gun violence calls for, quote, strange bedfellows. We have to come at it in a different way. Traditional methods don't always work. And he later added, and certainly Mayor O'Neill has a long history of community advocacy and certainly a knowledge of the streets of Durham that contributes to her ability to do the work. Gang-fueled violence in Durham and in much of the country has been a major issue during the pandemic. Over the past 2 years, the city reached a dismal plateau of more than 800 shootings, and last year tallied a record number of homicides. O'Neill is a lifelong Durham native who still lives in the modest red brick home her father built in the same West End neighborhood where Scott gives away books. Soon after Neal announced early last year she was running for mayor, she made clear that she wanted to make a difference in the lives of young people who in the past stood before her in the courtroom when she was a judge and are now dying or at risk of dying from gun violence in the streets. Voters heard O'Neill. She won with 85% of the vote. 3 months into office, O'Neill has taken the step of personally interacting with some of the city's ranking gang members. She shared with the Indy some of what's taking place behind the scenes. The work is revealing and astonishing. A large quantity of drugs went missing, and the gang members made call to other states in order to prevent bloodshed in the Bull City, she says. There was a night when young men who were, quote, riding six deep in a car, fully armed, locked and loaded, were intent upon carrying a revenge shooting. A community leader, quote, made a call to the gang members, and that was quashed. A mom and her children had to flee a nearby county because gunmen were threatening to shoot up her apartment while looking for one of her children. In order to ensure the family's safety, the call was made to, quote, the guys, who went to the woman's apartment and helped her retrieve clothing and other items after she and her children moved out. O'Neill says, I'm working harder than I have ever worked in my life to stop this violence. I can't put these boys on TV for media fodder. Every night no one gets shot. These men are doing their job. That's not fair to them, and the government has done nothing for them. It puts their lives in danger and me in danger, too. We ain't playing. This is dangerous work. She added, the difficult economic circumstances are compounding the issues young people in Durham are facing. These are awful times, she says. These guys can't get decent housing. They can't get jobs. How much are they being paid? Nothing. They've been neglected for so long. And Scott wants to intellectualize. Well, come do it yourself. Come on over here. Make a phone call. Tell them to stop the violence. Go ahead. Make a phone call. Middleton, the city mayor's pro tem, says it's important to remember that O'Neill, during her campaign, said she would not have the city's same media footprint as the city's past two mayors, Steve Shewell and William Bell, who made regular media appearances. And he says, no one should be surprised. She made it clear during her campaign she would do a different mode of mayoring. Middleton added that O'Neill didn't say she would never talk to the media about the gun violence. But he explains, right now, with the people she's working with, she doesn't want to spook them. The mayor is being who she said she would be. About a week after Scott posted his video, he says O'Neill's assistant phoned him and said the mayor wanted to meet with him. They met on March 8th at Franklin Village, an apartment complex on North Blacknell Street. O'Neill was accompanied by two gang members and Brenda Howerton, the chair of Durham County Board of Commissioners. Howerton couldn't be reached for comment, but O'Neill and Scott both agreed on one thing. The meeting did not go well. Scott says, let me put it this way. Like Michelle Obama said, when they go low, we go high. O'Neill says, he asked the gang members, where are the guns coming from? That's exactly what they don't want. It's a political stunt. Scott says he wasn't trying to put the gang members on blast. He says the ubiquitous presence of guns in African-American neighborhoods is part of a, quote, larger genocide agenda targeting the black community. That's where the question came from, he explains. The guns didn't fall out of thin air. They're coming from somewhere. Till we get to the root of that cause, we can't find the solution. O'Neill says Scott brought up the importance of exposing young gang members to books about the black experience. Gang members told him, she said, these kids aren't ready for books. They're trying to survive. Scott disagrees. He says it's important not to, quote, parrot the talking heads on Fox News. I think these young people on the street, at least the ones I deal with, want knowledge and information. O'Neill, a pioneering judge and retired interim dean of the NC Central University Law School, says Scott pulled out a copy of Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness. O'Neill says, I told him, yeah, I got the new Jim Crow. I lived that system. She says Scott got into an argument with the gang members, and then he told her that she had brought the two gang members along for protection. She says, I told him I brought them along to explain what was happening. The mayor said Scott, toward the end of the meeting, wanted her to be more specific after he asked why she thinks black people don't trust the government. That's when the bottom fell out of the planned private meeting. She says, I told him the answer I gave was all he was going to get. He persisted in being argumentative, and I lost my cool. I went on a rant about how I had walked these streets, and just 2 years ago eulogized one of my young cousins who had been killed on these streets, and he wasn't the first of my family members to die on these streets, and I said, I don't have time for this. I told him, this is the answer. I am the effing government, and I walked out. Scott told the Indy that, despite the way the meeting went, he and the mayor have the same, quote, end goal, he says. I would like a city council that reflects the interests in the area, like the HBCUs, he says, and not one that reflects the 3-6 mafia. I don't think it's useful for an elected official to not be open to criticism from Durham citizens, he later added. We want elected officials who will answer the tough questions. Make no mistake, ends this article, while Scott and O'Neill approach the topic of gun violence differently, both have the Bull City's best interest at heart. Next, from Carborough, Jasmine Gallup's article called Rent Racket. Rent increases are displacing residents of aging duplexes in Carborough. In 3 months, Alana Davis will pack up her home, load her life into a moving truck, and drive 150 miles southeast to Wilmington, where the housing costs are about 3 times cheaper than in the Triangle. Davis told the Indy, it's bittersweet. My partner grew up in Chapel Hill. This has been home for him, but we just can't afford to live here anymore. While moving to Wilmington is exciting and adventure, it's also pretty bitter to be priced out of a community we have deep roots in. Davis is one of the lucky ones. Her current job is a community organizer for nonprofit Carolina Jews for Justice allows her to work remotely, so she's able to live almost anywhere. She also has financial support from her family as she looks for a new home, a place she can buy and invest in long term. But many of her neighbors don't have those advantages, Davis says. The people who live in Regent Place, a group of aging duplexes around a cul-de-sac on Old Fayetteville Road in Chapel Hill, are teachers, single moms, people with special needs, and working class families. She says, I'm thinking a lot about my neighbors who don't have backup plans, who don't have flexibility in their budgets. Davis and her neighbors are being forced out of their homes because of an all-too-common phenomenon in today's housing market, local property owners selling to big companies. As the Triangle grows, property owners can make a quick buck from investors looking to capitalize on the demand for housing. It's a tempting prospect, especially if they're unable to maintain the property themselves. A $1 million check can be a lot more appealing than constant visits to fix the roof. And that's exactly what's happening in this case. Last fall, the owner of Regent Place, a local landlord with an LLC, sold the property to a global conglomerate, Graystar. That company, which owns more than 50 properties in North Carolina, is raising rent by nearly 20%. Heather Ray says they initially wanted to take mine from $1,210 to $1,550. If we went month to month, our rent would be $1,900. After a protest from residents, Graystar agreed to cap rent increases at $200, but that's still out of Ray's price range, she says. Ray and her partner struggle to make ends meet as it is. Graystar, in a response to a request for comment from the Indy, said in an email the rent increases will pay for, quote, an improvement program to the property. We appreciate the rapidly changing real estate market is a cause of concern to our Regent residents. It's our desire to see the Regent Place community prosper as we improve our environment and facilities. Paying higher prices is never welcome, but it is a reality of our current times. We are committed to working with our resident to cushion the impact of those increases and provide as much notice as possible. But residents say in the pandemic economy, providing notice isn't enough. Ray says, I'm an elderly undergrad student. I work part-time. I get a housing stipend. But because of the pandemic, that's been several months behind. and there's only so many hours I can work while I'm going to school. Davis has also had a tough time affording her rent, she says. Like Ray, she was hit hard by the pandemic, saying, I lost my job at the beginning of the pandemic, so I make about $20,000 less than I did when I moved into this place. I'm hard-pressed to even afford the rent without that increase because of the impact the pandemic has had on me. I just can't afford a $200 increase. Millennials today know that renting a home in the Triangle is a long, frustrating, and often expensive process. As of February, the average cost of a one-bedroom apartment was $1,340, putting it out of reach of anyone who makes less than $54,000 a year. The best option for many is to split the cost of a two-bedroom apartment with a roommate, a partner, or both. Even then, market rent, $1,500 for two bedrooms, can be unaffordable for people who make less than $30,000 a year. Demand for housing means investors usually don't have trouble finding people to rent expensive apartments. When the residents of Regent Place continued to protest rent hikes, they received a letter in return saying, quote, the lease renewal rates offered are below current market rent. That may be true, Davis says, but it doesn't help her or her neighbors who can't afford market rent. Our wages aren't impacted by the market value of real estate, she says. Graystar took a risk buying these places but didn't at all consider the human element, the impact that was going to be had on the humans that live here. All right, well, as far as hard news in the print version, that's all we have, but I'll go now to the online IndieWeek.com webpage. Supreme Court is going to hear the Leandro case once again. This Leandro case started in 1994 when families from five low-wealth counties sued the state, saying it was not meeting its obligation to educate all students equally. This story originally published, by the way, in Education NC. For the third time in nearly 30 years, the Supreme Court will take up the Leandro case. Monday night, the state's highest court put out an order granting the request of the plaintiffs and defendants to have its justices take a look at the case. The North Carolina Court of Appeals blocked the transfer of about $1.7 billion late last year that had been ordered by Judge David Lee to help the state get in compliance with its constitutional obligation to public education. A three-judge panel ruled 2-1 that while Lee might be right to say the funds are needed, it's not within his power to order that money be appropriated. Lee's order had directed the state budget director, controller, and treasurer to transfer from the unappropriated balance in general fund more than $1.5 billion to the State Department of Public Instruction, about $200 million to the Department of Health and Human Services, and $41 million to the University of the North Carolina system. Now again, that Leandro case started in 1994 when families from five low-wealth counties sued the state, saying it was not meeting its obligation to educate all students equally. The state Supreme Court ultimately said the state's children have a fundamental right to the, quote, opportunity to receive a sound basic education, and that North Carolina had not lived up to the constitutional requirement. The state as defendant is represented by attorneys for State Attorney General Josh Stein. At this point, they have essentially been acting in concert with the plaintiffs while the case has been in Judge Lee's court, and both support Lee's actions. But North Carolina House Speaker Tim Moore, Republican of Cleveland, and Senate President Pro Tem Phil Berger, Republican of Rockingham, have argued they aren't a party to the case and pushed back against Lee's order, saying that only lawmakers have the power to appropriate money. They finally asked to intervene in the case in December. Their attorney later asked the Supreme Court not to take the case. According to the order Monday, before the Supreme Court hears the case, they wanted to go back to Lee's courtroom, quote, for no more than 30 days. This is so Lee can see if the passage of the state's budget should impact his initial decision to force the state to hand over $1.7 billion. Lee had originally been waiting for the North Carolina General Assembly to pass a budget in hopes they would fund the first 2 years of a comprehensive plan designed to get the state in line with its duties. But when the process began to drag on, he went ahead and ordered the money himself. After budget passed in November, the North Carolina Public School Forum put out an analysis that determined it funded about half of what the comprehensive plan called for. The Supreme Court order Monday states, as soon as the trial court has certified to this court any amended order that it chooses to enter, this court will enter any such other and further orders governing the procedures to be followed in this case as it deems necessary. So, in other words, stay tuned. Well, still on IndyWeek.com, Jasmine Gallup enters another column about Wake County preserving 86 acres of green space. This is about the size of nearly 66 football fields, and it will be permanently protected from future development, thanks to a decision made Monday by the Wake County Board of Commissioners. The board voted to use funds from the 2018 Parks, Greenways, Recreation, and Open Space Bond to help preserve a 200-year-old working sheep farm in Zebulon. The Lazy J Ranch, owned by Patrick Johnson, is mostly pasture with some wooded areas of oak hickory forest, according to a news release. The 86-acre property also contains more than 3,500 feet of streams, some of which run up against Little Creek. The Wake Soil and Water Conservation District has certified that 99.7% of Lazy J's ranch soils are considered prime farmland or farmland of statewide importance. Commissioner Vicki Adamson said, Wake County is growing rapidly, and that's why protecting farmland and open space is so very important to this board. Not only does this decision conserve this special property, but it will help protect wildlife habitat and water quality. The county is protecting the land through a conservation easement. That's a voluntary legal agreement that permanently limits the uses of the land to protect its value. The cost of the easement, just over $1.3 million, is split between the county, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the NC Department of Agriculture and Consumer Services, and the Triangle Land Conservancy, which will hold and monitor that easement. Wake County's contribution is $350,000, with $281,000 coming from bond funds and $68,500 from NCDOT 540 settlement funding. The property is not open to the public at this time. Also Monday, the board voted, this is in addition to this land easement, the board voted to raise the pay of Wake County paramedics and other emergency medical workers by an average of 21%. The county has been struggling to attract qualified staff, especially as other EMS departments in the state and nation offer higher wages for fewer hours, according to Trinija Martin, Deputy Human Resource Director. In an effort to become more competitive in the labor market, the county is raising pay for about 327 EMS employees, effective April 1. The raises range from 1 to 29%, with an average increase of 21%. The starting salary for EMTs is now $20 an hour, up from $17 an hour. Paramedics start at $28 an hour, up from $21. Commissioner Matt Calabria, also chair of the board's Public Safety Committee, says, if we're going to retain and recruit the best folks, or in this market, any folks, to the positions we obviously desperately need filled, we've got to take substantial steps. This is a substantial step. All right, still in IndyWeek.com, Joe Killian, article originally published at NC Policy Watch. UNC Chapel Hill makes a list of 10 worst colleges for free speech. This is a nonpartisan foundation for individual rights in education, we will call them FIRE, F-I-R-E, dedicated to free speech and academic freedom on campus, cited last year's controversy over the university's botched hiring of Nicole Hannah-Jones. It's among the worst 10 colleges in the nation for free speech, according to this annual roundup. It cited last year's controversy, first reported by NC Policy Watch. The Chapel Hill Board of Trustees appeared to resist a vote on tenure for the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist, quote, based on Hannah-Jones' viewpoint, said a FIRE wrote. But the university, quote, went from bad to worse, the organization said when it began reading the emails of faculty members who had been critical of the Board of Governors to determine who may have leaked a donor agreement the school made with Walter Hussman, the wealthy Chapel Hill alum who lobbied against her hire behind the scenes for months before the issue came to a head publicly. From the critique by FIRE, quote, specifically, UNC targeted journalism professors Deb Acott and Daniel Kreis, who both have given interviews or spoken out on social media about their frustration with the university's handling of Hannah-Jones' tenure bid. UNC called Acott and Kreis in for investigatory meetings, claiming it was doing its due diligence to discover who had disclosed the allegedly confidential donor agreement between UNC and Walter Hussman, the mega donor after whom the journalism school is named. The problem? Neither Acott nor Kreis had access to the donor agreement before it was widely distributed. Thus, it would have been difficult for either professor to be the source of the alleged leak, making the investigation's focus on them appear to be retaliation for their criticism of the university. On the other hand, numerous administrators, development personnel, and administrative staff did have access to the document before its wide distribution, making the investigation into Acott and Kreis more concerning is the university's violation of its own privacy and electronic information policy, which provides that the university will generally not look through the emails of faculty members. By surveilling the emails of faculty critics, UNC brazenly ignored both this policy and basic notions of academic freedom. And the article has a sidebar with the full list of FIRE's 10 worst campuses for free speech in alphabetical order. You can find that at indieweek.com if you need to read it. Yale University, among these, also received a lifetime censorship award, which the FIRE said it reserves for, quote, those colleges that deserve special recognition for their commitment to censorship. Greg Lukianoff, FIRE president and CEO, said each of these colleges had the opportunity to restore the student and faculty voices they censored, but the leaders deliberately chose not to do so. We don't back down. If college leadership is willing to muzzle, censor, and punish their own students and faculty members, the public should know. And prospective students and faculty applicants should take notice of which colleges will go to outrageous lengths to silence their voices. FIRE will continue to advocate for free expression at these campuses and other campuses around the country. Jasmine Gallup again about Durham Meals on Wheels. They celebrate nearly 50 years. This program currently serves about 600 people in Durham County, where it delivered more than 200,000 meals last year. The celebration came as Older Americans Act Nutrition Program. That's a federal law that funds nonprofits like Meals on Wheels turn 50. Durham community members founded a local food delivery program only a few years later in 1975. And again, the program currently serves about 600 people in Durham County. According to spokeswoman Nia Richardson, last year volunteers delivered 201,000 meals to a total of nearly 1,000 people. Meals are delivered to those who are homebound and unable to drive because of age, physical impairment, or lack of transportation. The nonprofit works to fight food insecurity and malnutrition, according to a news release. Richardson stated in a statement that volunteers hope that a combination of regular Nutritious meals and social contact will help people remain independent and at home for as long as possible, as well as combat the health risks associated with feelings of isolation and loneliness. She went on, a daily visit or periodic phone call is a crucial component to supporting our clients' sense of well-being and connectedness. Volunteers help alleviate feelings of loneliness and isolation by providing a friendly greeting, delivering a warm meal, and checking discreetly to be sure clients are safe and healthy. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, social isolation significantly increases a person's risk of premature death, a risk that rivals those of smoking, obesity, and physical inactivity. Not only is loneliness associated with higher rates of depression, anxiety, and suicide, but among heart failure patients, it can increase the risk of death nearly 4 times and the risk of hospitalization by 68%. Loneliness is also associated with an almost 50% increase in the risk of dementia, while poor social relationships are associated with a 29% increase in the risk of heart disease and a 32% increase in the risk of stroke, according to the CDC. Ellie Hollander, president and CEO of Meals on Wheels America, said in this news release, despite decades of proven success and bipartisan support, funding for this program has failed to keep pace with a rapidly growing need for its services. With the nation's senior population increasing dramatically, now is the time to support local Meals on Wheels programs through volunteering, donating, and speaking out to ensure we are able to deliver for another 50 years. And Durham Meals on Wheels is in need of volunteers to deliver meals, pack meals, or make weekly phone calls to check on seniors. The nonprofit is also seeking donations to cover the cost of meals for people and their pets. And the IndyWeek.com gives a website link, which is not showing up here, but you could look at Meals on Wheels Durham or any of our community, listening communities, and find how you can contribute or help or volunteer. It's a worthy cause, I'll tell you. All right, back to the print issue, and a small article which is fairly comes out weekly called 15 Minutes, and it's interviews with various people. And this gentleman is Michael Oakes, 21 years old, third-year engineering student at North Carolina State and a candidate for the State House of Representatives in District 49. Jasmine Gallup conducted this interview. How did you decide to run for office? Answer, when I went to my first Wake County Libertarian Party meetup, I met Travis Grew, who is currently the chair. I looked him up and found him on Ballotpedia, and it was like someone turned on a light switch. I was like, wait, this isn't the guy in Washington. This isn't the guy in the Capitol building. This is a guy who's here at this bar with me. We're having some nachos. This is a guy whose beliefs I agree with and who's sort of an everyman. It inspired me. I didn't realize politics were so accessible and they could be used to such avail without being deeply entrenched in that political system. What does it mean to you to be a libertarian? A very common phrase that gets cited is, don't hurt people, don't take their stuff. As a libertarian, you look at the consequences of a decision. We need to make sure that people's rights are not being infringed on. Don't hurt people means there's no aggression, you don't attack people, you don't take things for them by force. Don't take their stuff is why you often hear about libertarians worried about things like the budget for the state or the country or taxation. What issues are important to you as a member of Gen Z? Housing affordability is a huge issue for people my age. We have all these young families moving to the Triangle for jobs, and they can't afford to live here. Raleigh housing prices have increased 35% in the last 12 months, which is staggering. One of the biggest barriers to success for students and young families is home ownership. If you have to rent forever, that's a huge liability. You can't save up. It might put strain on trying to put your kids through college or trade school. In North Carolina, especially with COVID, we've seen a lot of companies moving to have their employees work from home. The issue for cities is that for-lease office space is empty. We have these empty office buildings in urban areas near grocery stores, near businesses. If we were to streamline or incentivize the non-residential to residential rezoning there, they could be converted very easily into affordable housing, which would work with the low supply we're seeing in places like Raleigh. And final question, you support the legalization of marijuana. Why? Over half of nonviolent drug crimes are marijuana-related. That is billions of dollars spent on this failed war on drugs. There's just this huge waste of taxpayer money spent punishing nonviolent crimes. If you decide to consume marijuana in your home, you're not hurting anyone. Ethically, I don't believe it should be illegal. Even beyond the punitive side of it, there's this huge public appetite for legalization. 73% of North Carolinians want medical marijuana legalized, and 54% want both medical and recreational legalized. More importantly, only 22% of North Carolinians said the consumption of marijuana was wrong. And this man, again, is Michael Oakes, on the candidate for State House of Representatives, District 49. And now, Keisha Jennings, a music columnist here at Indie Week, is talking about festival fever. And this will continue into a short article concerning many festivals and events that are now reopening in the Triangle area. This weekend, the first Bull City Summit was scheduled to launch, merging music, art, science, and technology. The festival promises festival goers a unique experience with leading and breakthrough creatives, musicians, technologists, scientists, researchers, artisans, and entrepreneurs alike, according to its website. If its structure feels aligned with that of Moog Fest, the multi-day conference and festival, formerly in Durham, that honored Moog synthesizer inventor Robert Moog, it's because both festivals have UG Strategies founder Parag Bhandari in common. In 2018, Bhandari joined the Moog Fest team for a short tenure, though the following year the festival, steeped in logistical issues, canceled its 2020 dates. On the surface, the Bull City Summit has many of the shiny things a festival needs to survive: an array of sponsors and partners, aesthetically pleasing marketing, local partnerships, a user-friendly website, and engaging keynotes and workshops. Still, on March 21st, just a few days before the festival was set to launch, it was postponed. Over email, Bhandari says that though Bull City Summit was ready to move forward from infrastructure perspective, ticket sales suggested consumer hesitation about in-person events. He wrote in an email to the Indy, "That's not unusual in these times, and also it's a year one event, so we pivot." The festival is now scheduled to take place September 15 through 18. All music-related events, however, are still moving forward with evening live music showcases Thursday through Saturday, with tickets priced at $20 per show. The festival's delay speaks to the difficulties of getting a festival off the ground, something that was difficult even before the COVID pandemic, close look at the future of festivals in the Triangle. Because amid difficulties and current restraints, the local music and event scene continues to blossom, and local event planners continue to roll with the punches. In recent years, festivals have surpassed being trendy. The seeming profitability of festivals has come a long way from its do-it-yourself origins to attracting A-list celebrities and large corporate live music promoters. The public is often well aware of the number of attendees at some of the world's largest festivals. In 2021, despite the pandemic risks, Rolling Loud Miami hosted 75,000 people. Travis Scott's disastrous Astroworld saw 50,000. And prior to the pandemic, Coachella saw on average 150 to 250,000 festival goers each year, grossing $67 to $117 million in ticket sales. Here in the Triangle, festival attendance had varied widely over the years. With a solid decade under its belt, Hopscotch, for instance, had its attendance reported at around 25,000 a year. During Moogfest's 4 years run, it averaged about 10,000 music and tech lovers. And in 2019, at its inaugural event, J. Cole's Dreamville Festival drew an impressive crowd of nearly 40,000. This year, the festival, which is produced by Score More, the same promotion company behind Astroworld, is expected to surpass its first attendant record. Of course, when considering success and profitability of festivals as big business, attendance numbers aren't all about that matter, aren't all that matter. Nor do they reveal all there is to know about profit margins. The majority of festival expenses come from talent, including artists' fees, riders, and travel and lodging expenses, as well as security and insurance. It's easy for festival expenses to surpass the revenue they accrue in ticket sales and sponsorships. In 2011, when Coachella announced it was expanding from 1 to 2 weekends, the festival founder and producer, Paul Tollett, explained that he was, quote, approaching the supply and demand issue in his own unorthodox way. For Coachella, in securing talent for 2 dates, the hope was that the first weekend could cover production and overhead costs. The next weekend would create an opportunity for actual revenue. Beyond having a vision, making a festival happen takes follow-through. In 2017, the world gained a front-row seat to that fact when it witnessed in real time the massive flop of Fyre Festival, the luxury festival that wasn't. The year after Fyre Festival tanked, Durham experienced its own version of that event with the NC Hip Hop Festival. Though two other locally grown festivals, the Durham Hip Hop Summit and Beats and Bars Festival, had cultivated community roots with artists and hip-hop heads alike, the NC Hip Hop Festival website, which is still available online, heralded itself as NC's largest festival showcasing the best in hip-hop and R&B from across the world. Its flyer, released that summer in 2018, was packed with the names of hip-hop legends and local artists, among them Nas, Fonte, and Petey Pablo, some of whom were never officially booked or even aware of the event. And though a few artists did attend, the festival did not end up having a stage, and they performed instead on a platform a few inches off the ground. Artists and fans took to social media to express concerns. Lena Jackson, a rapper based out of Raleigh, "My name, as well as several other dope acts, was on the flyer advertisement from this festival. I wasn't there, and I know many of the other acts weren't either or were screwed over before or after they got there." One former festival partner, Heather Mandelkorn, president of the Holistic Hip Hop Collective, went so far as to create a Facebook complaint to gather consumer complaints. Mandelkorn, based outside of the state, had been brought on to help book talent. Over the phone, she described the event as a festival that was, quote, out to profit off the culture and not ensure a well-produced event occurred that represent hip-hop and NC in the best manner. In response to the backlash, festival organizers Alicia and Elijah Vick issued a formal apology and solicited feedback via a community survey. Although their website lists a festival date for 2021, it's not clear whether the Vicks produced another event. When thinking about the future of festivals in the Triangle, especially in an uncertain post-vaccine landscape, and with a mind toward planting sustainable roots, there are plenty of ongoing questions about how to create and measure festival success. Cicely Mitchell, co-founder of the Art of Cool Festival and past president of the Art of Cool Project, says, "In order to sustain a large-scale festival in this area, all stakeholders, such as city council entities and businesses, should provide money, resources, and infrastructure. But Also, consumers should buy tickets early and encourage others to visit and enjoy the festival. Success is relative to the stakeholder. I'm sure the festival owners measure success by ticket sales and profit and loss. City and council entities likely see success by economic impact. It just depends on the stakeholder. The audience might measure success by the experience they had, really. Echoing the importance of city and community support, K97.5 radio host and Carolina Waves CEO Miriam Tolbert adds, continued interest is required. Great lineups and curation, activities and attractions outside of just the festival itself. There need to be innovative and new concepts, proper planning and promotion. Curators John Law and Dasan Ahonu point out the unique experience is key. Ahonu is the co-creator of the Hip Hop South Festival, an initiative of Carolina Performing Arts Southern Futures that's scheduled to run April 22-3 in Chapel Hill. And he says, for a festival to survive, it has to offer a distinct experience. It can't just rely on the musical act. Curation is important. The music may draw attention, but that will ebb and flow. It's the experience and the way it's laid out that will have people talking and planning to come back. Law is the founder of the Durham Hip Hop Summit and the former producer of Beats and Bars. In addition to prioritizing the festival vibe, he says, quote, having a consistent group of hardworking people organizing helps a ton. Folks go to festivals to have a shared memory or feel they're a part of something bigger than them or simply to sing their favorite song with a few of their friends. The atmosphere is what will create that memory. And if it's dope, folks will come. Surveying the Triangle's festival hits and misses, another key question comes to mind. Is it the best geographical fit for festival culture? Bandari, the founder of Bull City Summit, is confident that Durham is a good fit. He says it's the reason why we invested into saving Moogfest in 2018, also for the city of Durham, and the potential here for events like that moving forward. During the early stages of the pandemic, Bandari's company produced events like Live in the Lot Music Series in the parking lot at Motorco Music Hall and last July's pilot for Durham Summer Wine and Food Festival. Both were successful despite the pandemic odds, and the number of attendees suggests that people in the Triangle are eager for more. But the biggest case to be made for cultural festivals in the Triangle, of course, is that rich culture already is here. Perhaps with the right programming, production, and curation, a new season of successful festivals is just around the corner. And in line with this festival article is the Indie Week Festival and Event Directory, which has now made its way back into Pages, and it looks very gratifying. And they're broken down by dates and a brief description and websites. But the prelude to this directory says, after a long 2 years, our masks are coming off. Carolina's COVID metrics are improving, and many of us are finally reaching a place in our lives where it feels like things are getting back to normal, whatever that looks like. And with a return to somewhat normal life comes a return to doing the things we used to love to do pre-pandemic. Top among them being going out to festivals. From Dreamville, which returns to Raleigh's Dorothea Dix Park early next month, to political conventions ahead of the primaries and midterms, to summer music festivals and concerts, food and wine festivals, art festivals, film festivals, pride, beer, strawberry picking, and much, much more. There's not a lot that's not back on the table this year. And this is our exhaustive list of local festivals to see what most interests you. There's bound to be something for you and your friends and family this spring, summer, or fall. Festival organizers will be taking care to ensure that you have as fun, safe, and yes, normal festival experience as possible. And now, folks, the IndieWeek.com will have this what their current schedule is in its entirety online. I'm not going to be able to have nearly much time to deliver even the little outline of events and festivals that are on record already as being set up soon. Some of them are already underway. So I'll read what I can, as I said, with a brief reference to when it is and a brief reference to the website where you can find out more information. But you can also go to indieweek.com and find out more in detail about these festivals. And we'll start with the ongoing, we'll start with things that are happening right now, starting this weekend. And we just read about the Bull City Summit. That's listed as March 23 to 26. And bullcitysummit.com. It's in various locations downtown Durham. In the A.J. Fletcher Opera Theater, that's right downtown near Mamandi, and the Duke Energy Center for the Performing Arts, pinecone.org presents Lunasa, L-U-N-A-S-A, on March 25th. That's Saturday. Also on 26th, that's Friday. And March 26th, Saturday, the Queer Joy Lunch Brunch, potluck picnic at the Big Tree on Duke campus. That's at oursacredcircles.org. Also on Saturday, the Orange County Democratic Party County Convention. That's, you can find out about Orange Dems, or orangedems.com. Sunday, March 27th, the Poor House, P-O-U-R, presents Road to Wonderland Circus Show. This is on Sunday. And facebook.com/events, Road to Wonderland. And at the Ackland FAM Family Day, that's at the Ackland Art Museum, ackland.org, is Make It With Metal. Also, Sunday the 27th, the Nazim Hikmet Poetry Festival is in Cary at the Paige Walker Arts and History Center. There's no time given, but you go to Nazim Hikmet Poetry Festival, N-A-Z-I-M-H-A-K-M-E-T Poetry Festival, all one word, .org. I'm going to take a glimpse, and it might be Turkish-related poetry festival. Now, March 30th to April 17th, the Playmakers Theater in Chapel Hill, playmakers.org, presents A Wrinkle in Time. I'm sure this is an adaptation of that children's book. And March 31 to April 1st, the Cosmic Rays Film Festival. That's cosmicraysfilmfest.com is on South Boundary Street in Chapel Hill Film Festival. Now, going on to next week, April 1st through 30th is the Run for Autism Camp, and that's sites.google.com/view/wild-swalk. That's all I have on that. Dorothea Dix Park presents the Dreamville Festival on April 2 to 3. dreamvillefest.com. And April 2nd, Cary Tacos and Taps is at Cocoa Booth Amphitheater, tacosandtaps.com. There is a Trunk Show Raleigh, Facebook at Trunk Show Raleigh. Vintage and Handmade Spring Block Market is on April 2. Annual Festival of Nations, the 4th Annual Festival of Nations, is at Durham Central Park on April the 3rd, sistercities-durham.com. And April 3rd, a new season of song. Carolina Contemporary Composers is at All Saints United Methodist Church over in Morrisville, qrcc.me/r7itjkwx. That's an easy one to remember. 5 Points Spring Tree Giveaway is at Fallon Park in Raleigh on April 3rd, weplantitforward.org. And Peter Lamb and the Wolves, that's a jazz pop group, plays at Cocoa Booth Amphitheater on April the 6th, boothamphitheater.com. And I'll get to other ones as I can, but April 7th, I can have a time for a few more. The Collection is live And they're at Lake Raleigh, and that's the corner of Main Campus Drive and Campus Shores Drive, live at lakeraleigh.com on April 7th. And Durham gives us, again, the full-frame documentary film festival from April 7th to April 10th, fullframefest.org. And Doc and Cover is a presentation from Pinecone at the Fletcher Opera Theater, downtown Raleigh. Pinecone.org will have more detail. It's on April the 8th. And also April the 8th through the 24th, the Umstead Park, United Church of Christ, 15 and over the age, Enemy of the People, a theatrical production. Now, the North Carolina Master Chorale has an afternoon of music by black composers at the Christ Baptist Church. I Will Lift Up Mine Eyes. That's on April the 9th. ncmasterchorale.org. And Haiti Heritage Center, a tribute to Pauli Murray and four world premiere by NC North Carolina composers. And that's from the durhamsymphony.org, April the 10th. And the Durham Athletic Park on April 10th, Realities Talent Show. That's from realityministriesinc.org, Talent Show. Again, over at Coca Booth on April 13th, the Mint Julep Jazz Band, boothamphitheater.com. April 15th, Tribute to Legends with Marcus Anderson's Let's Go Crazy Show, The Music of Prince at Booth Amphitheater, April 15th. Also on the 15th, Sherlock's Glass. Sherlock's Glass is Instagram, at Sherlock's Glass, Spring Bling. And the Living Well Community is in Franklinville on Rising Sun Way. Their website, deepriverfolkschool.com. April 16, Success at Foraging for Wild Edibles in the Spring. And also April 16th, Living Well Community, the same place, deepriverfolkschool.com. April 16, How to Build Your Own Tiny House on a Trailer or on Permanent Foundations. And another one, Learning Focus with Archery. And it's the same place, all those last three. Cocoa Booth is back on April 16th. Tribute to Legends with Bee Gees Now, the Music of the Bee Gees, on April the 16th. Well, now, as I said, there's lots more in this. It extends all through the summer and into the fall at these festivals and concerts and series. So I must stop now, and that's good because I've run out of breath to read about all these. I'll keep this issue to hand, and we can go and revisit some of these when my issue itself of Indie Week is a little thin, like it was this week. So John Federson is saying so long for now. This broadcast can be found in the podcast section of your website, ncreadingservice.org, and so can a library of Indie Weeks and Independence for the last, looks like, 20 years. So I hope you'll give that a look if you want to. And in any event, I will probably be here again in a week to deliver the next issue of Indie Week. Thanks for listening.